Second prediction during that period was severe earthquakes. And I already told you, and I brought the documentation with me, that period 1976, one of the worst earthquake periods in human history in terms of life loss, number of earthquakes, magnitude of earthquakes. 77 was a very, not as big as this, but still an unusual number of earthquakes, and 78 also. So this is a matter of record time. I might point out, I clicked all the New York Times articles since I was looking for this, and at the beginning of 1976, there were a whole series. I mentioned the main one, the Guatemalan earthquake, and then there were other earthquakes, one after another, all over the earth. And Waverly Persons, who is the spokesman for the U.S. Geological Survey in Colorado, made a statement in about April of 76 that what we're seeing is just a transient phenomenon. It's really nothing to be worried about. By the end of 76, he made the statement himself officially. He had to contradict himself that it was one of the worst earthquake years in recorded history. And I don't want to go into all the individual things, but another statement that was made was three, severe cold for that period, globally. And I don't have to tell anybody from the Buffalo area how bad the winters were in 76 and 77 and 78. You all know about that. And that was a global phenomenon, not just Buffalo. The other thing that was very strange was a prediction about mysterious colds in the earth. These did not get much attention in the press. We probably never heard about them. But the typical example I've already described is the Belle Island case in Newfoundland. These mysterious holes in the earth were not due to internal pressures causing volcanoes or cracks. These were due to the Soviet ERF. And there were many of these that were tracked down by the military, because as I told you, these giant lightning balls produced by the Soviet signal, and now of course by the American signal that I mentioned from South Africa, when a lightning ball bursts, it produces a signal to satellites who are looking for nuclear explosions, so-called double signature of. You have two light flashes that occur with the detonation of a nuclear bomb. So this is of great interest. And unfortunately, we don't know whether these kind ever occurred before in history because nobody ever looked for them. And so this was quite a new phenomenon. I have to put this as holds. The only thing we know about that was comparable to these was the great Tunguska explosion over Siberia, which devastated an enormous area, hundreds and hundreds of square miles, just flattened without radioactivity. And scientists are still speculating as to what caused that event. So this is a brief condensation up to 1978. I might just add that from 78 here, I'll just put the year, to 88, and I'll just read it off to you. We have forecast a whole series of earthquakes, which are going on all the time. Volcanoes. Now, I don't know how many of you are aware of what's going on in terms of volcanic activity. You know about Mount St. Helens because in the United States we saw it on television and so on, but that's a very minor little volcanic eruption. Something like El Chinchon down in the Yucatan in Mexico, which occurred two and a half months ago, is more pertinent to what we're talking about. These volcanoes and the eruptions have been predicted. There's a secret report to which I was privy, which was given to one of our intelligence agencies, prepared by a group of geologists from the United States. The meeting was held at Princeton. And this meeting, which was about a year ago, predicted that within the next 4 or 5 years, that every year we would see some 25 volcanoes a year erupt, which have never been known to erupt within recorded time, okay? And so what's happening now has been foreseen by geologists. When this material was given, as I say, in late 1975 and early 1976, no such forecast existed on a global scale. Now, you may not be aware of what this means when volcanoes go up. The important thing about a volcano is how many cubic miles of dust is thrown into the air. It has been calculated that if we get something like 30 to 35 cubic miles of dust in the atmosphere, it's enough to initiate an ice age. An ice age doesn't mean that the whole planet becomes a frozen ball. An ice age simply means that the temperature drops 6 or 7 degrees Fahrenheit. It's not very much, but it's enough to cause cool nights, cooler days because of the vast, here's the Earth, of the vast envelope of volcanic dust, 30, 35 cubic miles, which screens enough of the sun's rays to prevent plants from growing properly, keeps the temperatures down, and changes the dynamic of the Earth heat engine. So, volcanoes, I think you should watch carefully what happens when each one erupts, and note if you get the data. Most newspapers are sloppy about giving the data on the calculated amount of dust that's been released. The way that's measured, incidentally, in case you don't know, is our government and other governments, we send up U-2 planes that have such special sampling devices, and they fly right through the cloud, and they estimate the number and the weight of dust particles per cubic centimeter. For that, they calculate by other measurements, usually satellite measurements, the distribution and the thickness of the dust cloud, and that's how they come up with these numbers, like 100 million tons of sulfuric acid or whatever it is of volcanic dust, they convert that into cubic miles. So that was a very important factor in the weather. So far, the big Indonesian volcanoes that have blown up, you remember the one just east of Java that blew up several weeks ago, and the dust cloud was so bad that several jet planes, commercial jetliners, going through the dust cloud, had their engines, you know, the jet-type engine, totally fouled up, and they went in a nosedive to cleaner, lower altitudes, hoping that they could blow the dust out of the engines. In both cases, the pilots were successful in getting the engines started again. So that gives you an idea of what volcanic dust can do. Now, in these 10 years, another form of disaster is forest fires. I'm sure all of you are aware that just 2 weeks ago, a huge forest fire started out in western Alberta. And the last I kept track of it until I hit the road was some 250,000 acres of forest had gone up. And the smoke was so bad, it was picked up all the way down in Missouri. So you have about 10 of those going on the planet, and you get so much carbon dioxide in the air that, again, you upset the whole heat engine of the world, and a lot of profound weather effects occur thereafter. Floods I don't have to tell you about. You pick up a paper almost every day and you see that the Earth is being hit with floods all over the place. We have in the United States the terrible floods in Japan in the last month, which I'm sure you've all read about, and other places. So floods seem to be a very strange part of this phenomena in a cooling climate, the heat engine is, as I explained already, sends up more heat from the tropical regions to the northern regions, which makes for more snow, which makes for bigger and colder winters, and the whole thing is a very complex cycle of events. There are other things which I'll get to tomorrow, but in this period in which we're coming into the next 7 years, one of these statements, which I'll read in detail, is that there will be 25 major cracks in the Earth's tectonic plates, which would be the source of toxic gases and foul odors. I haven't got to that detail, but that's one of the things. So when the Earth, you know, we all know now the standard tectonic plates through the Atlantic, the Great Western North and South America plate, the plate through Borneo and the Southern Pacific, and the Pan-Pacific plate, Japan, all the way down to Malaysia and Indonesia this way, and then of course the Himalayan plate and the Mediterranean plate. Well, what is this is saying that there will be new cracks other than the ones that we know, the well-established ones. And these may not necessarily be along continental ridges as they are now. They may be intracontinental. Example, recently, about a year or two ago, it was published that a major crack was discovered in the inside of the United States that nobody ever suspected was there. And part of that crack runs from Charleston, South Carolina to Missouri, and then it goes north, and a branch of that crack goes eastward and comes into New England and to the Canadian Shield area. And as you know, there have been a lot of earthquakes in New England, if you follow the papers at all, in the last 6 months, which haven't been reported since about the 1600s. So that's a kind of ancient crack which exists, which nobody knew was there because it wasn't doing anything. It has produced some of the greatest earthquakes in North America. In 1812, the whole area of Missouri and Kansas, the ground was like a rolling wave at sea. The earthquakes were so tremendous, destroyed everything in sight. Fortunately, there weren't very many people living there. But those kind of cracks, I think, is what is being indicated will be activated as part of this tribulation that all of us are going to have to go through. Yes, Anna?
Could you give me an idea of where in the Canadian Shield?
Where in the Canadian Shield? The classic crack goes down the St. Lawrence River, the whole St. Lawrence thing, which is, what, 1,500 miles long. And there are side branches off of that. I can't give it to you from the top of my head exactly where, but you can get that from standard publications. I think Chicoutimi, north of Quebec, is one of the cracks.
What was that?
The area, Chicoutimi. I thought you were Canadian, you would know. There is a crack in the area of Montreal. I don't know the exact, but it's all, you can, there's a place in Montreal where you get all these maps, shows all these cracks. I can't remember off the top of my head. Overlooked. Anyway, that's just a little brief condensation, just to pull some of the material together that we covered, and I'll fill out the whole chart all the way up to the year 2000 before we get through. But that's the kind of thing. The only reason I bring this up, that was forecast, that did happen except the seventh seal. I never saw the seventh seal open, obviously. But that's what the writings are supposed to be about. So the earthquakes we've had, the severe cold we've had, the holes we've had, which are very strange, and as I say, they're really ultimately man-made by the Soviet ELF signals. But
You mentioned one of those.
Bell Allen, yeah. But there are a lot of others that the government immediately rushes, sends a whole team of people to, and they never tell anybody what happens. Because they're just as puzzled, I think, as anybody else. It's unexpected. The reason they're valid is that it gives them a false signal for nuclear war. Speaking about that... One of the horrible, discouraging things of the last few years, are you aware that in the year, the last year that the Pentagon has published the data, 1980, there were 53 false alerts of Soviet missiles coming into the United States?
Just 53?
Just 53. Each time everybody in the Pentagon goes on full alert, and they usually track them back to failures of components. Some little chip in a computer, some part of a sensor, and that's what they tell us publicly. I'm sure there are a lot of minor glitches. So, I don't think you have to worry about natural disaster. Someday, somebody's not going to pick it up as a mistake. I don't know when that's going to be, but that is one of the background noises of the life we live in today. Yes, Ted?
What are the dimensions of these holes?
What's what?
The size of these holes that are made by the... You know,
they're not very big. Our group, when I say our group, some of you are members of it, Planetary Association for Clean Energy in Ottawa, sent a team there, and the holes that were measured and reported on in our journal in Newfoundland, the Belle Island incident, were about a meter across and a meter deep of hard granite, and they had this triangular configuration. Nobody has any idea why. I mean, this is like a borehole going right into granite. It's almost, and of course everything around it was vaporized, and it hit the building, and a lot, the full story is reported in the journal. But they're not very big, but nothing like it has ever been seen. And they have been discovered in other parts of the world where ball lightning generated by a Soviet ELF transmitter has occurred. How are we doing? Have we got everybody on track now? We got some big holes out left. Okay, well listen, since we've got everybody in equilibrium, as they say, why don't we turn it off and start again tomorrow. This discussion never ends with what I'm saying up here because it goes on, as some of you know, for hours afterwards.
Could I ask you a little question?
Yeah. Excuse me, one more question.
What is the name of the book that you said you were quoting from that you didn't
know? From the book which is based on the clock messages. And I was saying, and I'm making a very subtle distinction, saying that's what the text says, which I wrote, okay? And it's a forecast of the future. But I said that I'm not sure that these things will occur as they were written. I'm simply reporting something that was given to me. Do you understand the subtle difference? Because I'm reporting, it doesn't mean I necessarily believe it's going to happen. Does that bother you?
Why don't you tell her about the messages?
Did anybody see the story in the Jamestown paper about our meeting here? The amazing thing was there was a straight story. It wasn't a ha-ha or tongue-in-cheek about what we're discussing here. Anyway, you can check the paper and see it for yourself. I was rather surprised that Lilydale is getting such good press, I guess.
Yeah.
Good relations built up.
That's today's paper,
yesterday. I'm going to start reading again from the text and try to explain it as best I can. I'm quoting now. This is the first 90-month period I'm referring to. Quote, there will be cold for the first 68 months. In the first 68 months of the 90-day period, which is 5.09 years, runs from the beginning, which is of this cycle, December 1st, 1975, to January 1981. Now, I don't have to belabor that point. That entire five-year period, anybody's interested in looking up the record, to see that we've had unusually cold weather, not just in North America, but all over the planet. As the winter rolls from the northern hemisphere to the southern hemisphere, they've had the same problem down under, as we say. Showed flash flooding in Arizona, of all places. And as you know, there were floods in Tennessee yesterday. And so it goes. And I just clipped an article from the New York Times, and this is dated May 22nd. And the headline says, "Heavy rains cause wide flooding in the Midwest." And it goes on to describe floods in place after place, 8 inches of rain, 10 inches of rain, 8.5 inches of rain, spotted all over. So this is what we've been living with, and none of the floods have been epic making. In other words, an area gets saturated, and then it moves on to another area, and it gets saturated, and the first area recovers. But this is all part of the heat engine that I described to you, where for a lot of reasons, a trapped greenhouse effect, you have more heat. When you have more heat, there's more evaporation, because it takes a certain amount of heat to cause the water to evaporate, and that goes by the heat engine of the earth toward the northern climates, and it just dumps rain here and there, except now it's dumping it in record quantities. Now, that cycle will end pretty soon, as I just indicated, this year. Now, coming up for the next 7 years, I quote again, there will be explosions, that means volcanic type of explosions, quakes, and eruptions over the entire 10 years. From the timing of this, I must explain, this is from 1978 to 1988. And as you know, we're entering that period now. Again, I quote, during the first half of the above 68-month period, which we just described as being one of cold, there will be holes in the earth and splittings of the earth. I stopped the quote there. I already described what those holes are, besides volcanic eruptions and earthquake movements connected with earthquakes. There have been these very strange lightning ball type of effects on the earth. The full significance of that I don't understand. If we had the full data on the globe and could plot where every one of these occurred, we might learn something important about the weather control of the earth, but we don't have that kind of data, unfortunately. During the latter half of the 68-month period, which as I just said ends January 1981, there will be mysterious storms. I end the quote there. Now, the mysterious storms are partly what I've already described in terms of volcanic dust in the air. The first of this type of cycle we know as the sulfur dioxide present in the air. The third kind of mysterious storm is that connected with the depletion of the ozone layer. And when the ozone layer depletes around the earth, it's not a uniform depletion. There are places where there are so-called holes, which allows a lot of sun to go through. And when a lot of sun gets through, it causes a lot of destruction of plant life, abnormal weather, and we believe induction of new diseases. There are viruses that have been latent for a long time, get a new lease on life, and take over. Those we don't fully understand because mankind is not prepared to record and document that kind of an effect. And I'll give you a small for instance. The U.S. Pentagon, in its Buck Rogers fashion, had considered for some years, particularly during the Vietnam War, of destroying the enemy's crops by shooting laser, high-powered laser, megawatt laser, into the atmosphere so that it would go high enough to punch holes in the ozone layer. So over that part of the earth there would be an open hole and the ultraviolet would come down, of course, kill crops, animals, allow diseases to go ahead. Anyway, as far as we know, that plan was never put in operation. And for those of you interested in that kind of thinking that goes on in the military of all nations, Lo Pani wrote a very good book called The Cooling, which came out, I believe, about 3 or 4 years ago. I don't remember the exact date. But The Cooling describes all of these kinds of schemes. How many of these have gone into operation that we don't know anything about is a very important question. And I'll give you one for instance. About 3 years ago, in 79, there was a big story run in newspapers and in some detail in the National Enquirer about an unusual kind of storm, and that's just a word, that occurred over Petrozavodsk, Russia, which is in the area of between Finland and Leningrad. And in that area, there were observed the following effects. First, balls of lightning, lightning balls without lightning, fell down just like meteors in this area, were seen visibly, they lit up the countryside, and they appeared to be falling from a giant, what was described as a jellyfish organism, many miles across, and with a huge dome, with the balls of fire falling from the edge. When these balls of fire hit various cities, and Petrozavodsk was one of the hardest hit, the energy of the lightning balls was hard enough to melt granite pavement blocks, and when it hit buildings, it would burn holes in the stone of walls. There were some injuries, there was a lot of terror. This kind of, quote, storm, unquote, lasted for about an hour and a half. Now, the Soviet Union put out an official report about this particular storm. There were many more. And they said there was a UFO blitz over the Soviet Union, which is kind of funny because they, like the U.S. government, have always denied that UFOs exist. The real fact of the matter is determined by our Planetary Association group, after a lot of research and interview, was that there was one of these giant ELF transmitters in that area, which was Riga, which is about 100 miles to the southwest, and they had an unusual standing wave, one of these columnar waves that I described earlier, which simply exploded a giant fireball right near the transmitter, but about 100 miles away. And that caused a giant jellyfish, and it caused a secondary little lightning ball eruptions and caused all the damage. So that's the kind of thing that's been going on and not reported, which covers this phenomenon of mysterious storms. Unfortunately, as I say, we don't really have a lot of knowledge of that, because most of that is covered up in the countries in which it occurs. We've had some effects like that in this country, and you may have read about in the papers, particularly around Eugene, Oregon, where there have been unusual ELF activity, and Eugene, Oregon went from a peaceful rural village in 1 year to a city or a town that had the highest increase in crime rate in the United States, something like 300% increase of all crimes, all the way from homicide to petty larceny. And this again was due to the presence, I'm sorry to say, not of the Soviet ELF, but of the American ELF, with which our people were experimenting, and they picked this little town as a target, just like the Soviet Union picked Timmins, Ontario, as a target to see what would happen to the people. So that is what is meant by that one statement. I continue. During the 80-month period, that's the one that's going to begin next. The earth will split in 25 sites, with foul odors coming forth, with trembling and earthquakes. Now that process is going on right now in a small way. If you remember what happened in Mount St. Helens, it started out with a major eruption 2 years ago in May, a year and a half ago, and since then that activity has moved south about 600 miles, and those of you who follow the news or the television know that the Mammoth Lake area of California, Northern California, right now is one of the beginning signs of this kind of activity, in which the hot springs are bubbling up more than ever observed in Mammoth Lake area. The whole area is lifted up about 10 inches. Scientists are desperately measuring the depth at which the lava, hot lava, is coming up underneath. And there is a prediction that this area will sooner or later blow up. Nobody knows when. I personally suspect that it'll blow up much sooner than any of the scientists think. But this is what is meant, 25 major cracks in the earth which will give rise to volcanic eruption, and which is not the bad part because that's a local effect. The lava can only flow so far. The real danger is the what's called foul odors in the Hebrew language, but which we know are poisonous, toxic gases, which will contaminate the atmosphere and make life very difficult in certain places. Now, that in general, and I'll summarize all this on the board, are the main statements made about the coming 7 years, which all of us are concerned about naturally. So I will outline these and hope to get it done before we have the break, to give you a kind of an overall scheme to summarize this disjointed material in a graph. You already have the copy of the graph from yesterday, so I'll continue from that period on. We'll start now in 1978, and we'll give a date here. And we will give the actual prediction. And something about the fact, if we have any facts that will clarify what's going to happen in the future. So, I'll just cover the last 34 month period, the first 34 month period, the last 34 month period of the 68 month period which I gave you. And this covers the period from August 78 to February 81. And the predictions for this area I just ran over. One I didn't mention, it said fortress. That, as you know, has to do with children, not with us. By 79. As I indicated to you, that's all done and under operation. The mysterious storms I just described, but not in great detail because they are so mysterious, they're very hard to deal with, and they're not the typical storms that we know about. And then, of course, all the other holocausts, just call it the holocaust, that's earthquakes, volcanoes, and other fire phenomena from the earth. And that's pretty well known now that that did occur. Now, we have the 23-month period here, and that covers roughly, on this last day, 281, to, which make it September for around number 82, instead of the tail end of August, okay? There's some interesting phenomena connected with that. Have any of you ever read a book called Aquacor by a German journalist called Brugger? And it was a book published in 1978. Aquacor is spelled A-K-O-R. Now, Aquacor, I'll give you a brief synopsis of this book. Remember yesterday I mentioned the Mayan legends and their record inscribed on stone of the last four major catastrophes that hit the earth, and we're at the end of the fifth, and the next one, next stage is the sixth. But curiously enough, this book written by the German journalist in a way reinforces the Mayan information. And what it says briefly is this. Brugger was assigned by his news agency in Germany to Brazil. And specifically, he was assigned to Managua in the Brazilian Amazon heartland, the old heartland of the rubber industry, which is now defunct because of the introduction of synthetic rubber. And he was asked by some Brazilian military men to talk to an Indian chief who had come from the Andes. So he did. The Indian chief spoke, strangely enough, only his own language and German. And it turned out the reason he spoke German is that his tribe captured a German missionary group, including some nuns, many years ago, and his father, the father of this chief, whose name is not important, it's a very difficult name to pronounce, the chief of a tribe called the Uga Mangalara. And this chief, I'll call him Tatunka for short, said that his father's people captured this German nun, and she became the war prize to his father, who succeeded the original chief, and they were married by the tribal customs, and apparently it was not a forced situation. And so this chief, Tatunka, was half Indian and half German, and his mother taught him German, but he spoke the kind of German a child would learn. It's not a cultured or polished or, they say, Hochdeutsch type of German. Anyway, because he was a chief, he was privy to the secrets of his tribe. And the secrets of his tribe, I can summarize very briefly. This tribe
descended from a group of extraterrestrials who landed on this earth 13,000 years ago and taught these people all their arts and culture and language and so on. And then they told them that the earth was going to be wiped out by a catastrophe, an earthquake type of catastrophe, and they built for them very large, elaborate underground cities, the famous tunnels that you read about in the Peruvian Andes. And there were rather unusual technological marvels in these tunnels that the people had forgot. The point of the story was that these extraterrestrials left, the people went underground, the earth did get devastated, all life was wiped out, and they alone, as far as they knew, at least in their part of the world, survived. And so life began anew, another 6,000 years went by, and the space beings returned and told them there's going to be another catastrophe, this time a flood, this is the Noah flood. And again they went underground and they left. So the space beings have been coming back to the Indians now and saying that the next great catastrophe is about to occur. And this chief, for some reason or other, I think he was just as foolish as I, decided to go and tell somebody about it. And so he made this long trek of 2,000 miles to the nearest contact point in Brazil with the white man. And he calls the white man the white barbarians because of the destruction they have inflicted upon the natural ecological balance of the Brazilian Amazonian territory, particularly in terms of cutting down trees, exploiting it for oil, gas, etc., killing the Indians, which is a well-known crime that's going on right now. And so he wanted to deliver this message and then get back to the jungle. Well, the reporter was so astounded and he had no way of verifying what the man was telling him that he said, can I go back with you and at least see the underground cities, etc.? Tatanka said yes, so they started upriver by canoe, which is a long, long trek going upstream. And they went quite a distance, probably about 1,000 miles, and the canoe tipped over, the equipment got wet, and the reporter got nipped a little bit by some piranhas. Anyway, he freaked out and decided that he didn't want to be a hero and turned back. But the Silk Road had built a story in his mind, and he went to the Brazilian authorities and was able to verify some of what Tatanka had told him. So he decided that even though he couldn't prove the whole story, he ought to publish the results. And the interesting thing about the statements, this, I think these statements were made in 77, was that the, I have the date here somewhere, that the catastrophe predicted by the chief Tatanka is to occur starting in this year of 1982. So I thought that might be of interest to you if you want to get the book and read it. According to the Akako, is the name of the civilization, incidentally. According to the Akako prediction, and this prediction, as you gather, was made some 13,000 years ago, initially, says that it will be flooding that will occur at this time. It doesn't go on to say any of the other things that I have said at all. But it is strange, and it's a pity that that story was not verified in some way by the reporter. I know if I'd have been there, I would have been deterred at all by a few piranhas having to go ahead and try to get the fact.
You get the author of that book.
Right. Brugger, B-U-R-G-G-E-R. Heinrich, I can't remember his full name. Karl Brugger, I think. All right, now during the same period which we have covered here, I also have told you that from, I'll have to do a little overlapping, from 81 down to 85, there's something called secret knowledge. interestingly enough, even though this process starts a little earlier, I should go back here to be absolutely accurate. Let me tell you how that goes. I told you a little bit about it in my case. I'm going to put down a landmark year here in a big letter somewhere. You got to put it right here. A remarkable thing happened in the year 1977. Again, I want to recapitulate a few things. Starting in 1972, as I've already indicated to you, we initiated the first impact in probably known history of a powerful psychic and his doings, namely Geller, and then subsequently all the people who did the same thing that he did, with the scientific community. And I already described to you our adventures in many universities, and I didn't go into all the details of the government interactions in Britain and Germany and the United States, Israel, etc. They were also part of this investigation, and mostly because the governments got a little panicky about what an individual psychic could do to very sophisticated monitoring and sensing equipment that control defensive weapon systems like anti-ballistic missile systems. It was a very turbulent period of interaction between the psychic side and the scientific side. And in between we had a lot of chaff, all kind of magicians. I remember the famous, in England, they had a fellow called Bongo the Magician. Every time Uri Geller got up, Bongo would jump up and say, "I can do the same thing but better, and it's all a trick." And so it was in every country, and the whole thing was, but that was all chaff. That was not the real action. The real action was between very serious psychics who tried to demonstrate their abilities under laboratory-controlled conditions as scientists, and the scientists of unusual background and stature who began to look seriously at the phenomena. In this group were at least five well-known Nobel laureates, and some of them have come out recently and made their interests known. People like John Eccles of Australia, and Trigger Jean of Belgium, and Brian Josephson of Cambridge, and so on down the line. And a lot of other scientists from very distinguished research organizations in the world. And when they saw with their own eyes in the laboratory things that could not be explained, like the levitation of objects under controlled platform conditions, the bending or cracking of metal, the disappearance of objects, the teleportation of objects, and so on, they realized that they were looking at something much more profound than science had ever looked at before. I somehow got involved in the center of this maelstrom simply because I traveled so much and because I was seriously interested in the scientific foundations of this. And some of the early people who got involved, you might be interested. For example, Tom Bearden, whom you all know now, in 1975 was a recently retired lieutenant colonel from the Army, totally unknown in the world, and one of our colleagues by the name of Ira Einhorn discovered him down in Alabama and brought him into the circle of activity. People like Christopher Bird kind of tagged along and loved a lot of what was going on as the Boswell of this activity. And I could go on and name a whole group of scientists that collected, and this came to be known in the press as the Far Out Physics Underground. And Bell Telephone of Pennsylvania very generously paid for all the transcriptions of our meetings, of our records, of our publications or papers that we'd written and hadn't had time to publish. And we had a mailing list of some 170 scientists in 35 countries, and every 2 weeks a batch of papers were circulated throughout this group, and these ideas were rapidly being evaluated, exchanged part of that group. And these ideas, as I say, circulated, and by about 1976 it became urgent that we have some kind of a meeting and really exchange views more deeply, because what we were doing, we would call four or five or six of anybody who was available in an area and do a seminar at the University of California, Berkeley, or University of Toronto, or University of Pennsylvania, or Harvard, wherever we had an open door and somebody would let us in and give us a space and we'd talk. And most of these meetings were attended by, thank goodness, young students, that is, graduate students who were seriously trying to get their academic orientation, and we caught them at a point where I think maybe we helped them from getting trapped in the old method and they could see some new things. Anyway, the result of all this activity was a conference in Iceland in late October 1977, in which all these ideas were fully discussed. And as chairman of the conference, I was very privileged to make a statement which was very appropriate, I thought, at the time. John Haysted, head of the Department of Physics at London University, got up and reported on 10,000 observations of metal bending by young people in Britain, Great Britain. And these were all essentially pieces of metal hung up on wires, and the people who were concentrating on them couldn't touch them, and they would just do it mentally. And there were strain gauges and other sensors in the metal which would record on the strip chart all the perturbations caused by the mine. And when he got through with his presentation, which was pure experimental data, Olivier Costa de Beauregard of the National Institute of Research in Paris, and who was a pupil of Einstein, got up and gave a long talk, about an hour and a half, in which he reviewed all of the important unsolved problems of modern physics and showed that modern physics demands that psychic phenomena or powers or energy must exist. So if I felt, being caught as chairman between these two giants, that I was listening on the one hand to Faraday, who gave all the data, and on the other hand to Clark Maxwell, who had just given his theory of electromagnetism. And it was really an electric moment in history, I thought, when this data came forth, fully worked over, polished, and checked by colleagues, etc. The result of that was we published something called the Iceland Papers, which some of you have seen, which pulled all this stuff together. At the same time we were having a meeting in Iceland, a group of mostly German scientists was meeting at the University of Marburg in Germany, and they subsequently published a book called Electromagnetic Bioinformation, edited by Fritz Albert Puff, in which they took up another aspect of the same problem. And while they were not dealing with psychic phenomena per se, they were dealing with healing phenomena. And what they showed, and I think I should briefly tell you some of this new knowledge that's popping up, what they showed was that plants, seedlings, for example, when they are growing very rapidly, as they are just germinating, give off laser-type radiation, particularly in the ultraviolet band, and they measured this with very sophisticated equipment. The general work had been anticipated by a Russian called Gurwitch back in the early 1920s, in which he showed that onion roots, when they were growing and dividing, would give off ultraviolet radiation, which he called mitogenic radiation, because this radiation would stimulate other onion roots to grow and divide. Well, the German workers not only proved this on growing plants, but they discovered a lot of other interesting things. When plants suddenly died or were made to die under artificial laboratory conditions, at the moment of death or dying, they also threw off a tremendous amount of ultraviolet radiation. So when they were rapidly growing, they produced the radiation, and when they were dying, they produced the radiation. Now, all this may not seem very profound to you, but let me explain some of the implications of these findings. You've all heard of the Shroud of Turin, right? Now, the Shroud of Turin, if you understand what's going on, in cross-section through a human body, here's a human body in cross-section, longitudinally go this way. If you wrap a shroud around it like this, you can get a portrait on the shroud, on the back side of the body and on the front side and all the way around, only if something called flash photolysis. All that means is photolysis. All that means is that if suddenly the body that's in there lets loose an ultraviolet radiation briefly, can be for a matter of seconds, it will imprint an image which can be reconstructed. The ultraviolet rays coming out here will create an image on the cloth which would last and can be reconstructed later. And it turns out that the researchers at Sunny Laboratories in Mexico did this job, set up the whole model on the computer, and were able to show exactly what I described, that the radiation coming off would produce the image at exactly the right points and exactly the right angles on the cloth. And as you know, when they reconstructed this, you read the books, on a computer, they could turn this image around like a pig on a spit in the computer and show the three-dimensional model of this body. And they were able to reconstruct every mark, every detail on that body that was in the center of the shroud. Now the shroud is allegedly the shroud that encased the body of Jesus Christ at the crucifixion. That's a legend. Nobody can prove it. Now, all that is needed to prove that this was the body of somebody who lived in the time of Christ is to take a little piece of the cloth and subject it to radiocarbon dating. If you got a date that was anywhere near the time of the crucifixion of Christ, you would have some proof that this may indeed be the body of Christ. And what's interesting, of course, the church in Turin, incidentally, will not allow that to be done. They're not particularly interested in verifying the historicity of Jesus Christ and their political reasons behind all that. Now, the final point of this, related to the German work, is that a body, a plant, a living mammalian organism, in a moment of great crisis or suffering, could throw off this kind of flash photolysis effect. Or if you had something the opposite, where you had a body that was so-called dead and then resurrected, just like the seeds that are giving off this radiation when they're dividing, a body coming back to life could also give off this kind of radiation. So you have very interesting possibilities. Anyway, all this came to light. Incidentally, the first major conference of the Turin Society, which is headquartered in Connecticut, also was in 1977. The German work on electromagnetic bioinformation and the Iceland papers. And there came out a very interesting conference that nobody ever heard about. They never made headlines. It's just a small group of people who got together in that particular period of 1977. So that was that period of 1977
was the beginning of getting together workers in these esoteric areas, and totally outside the mainstream of modern science, but also in a way were outside of the mainstream of people in psychical work, of people in psychical research and spiritualism and so on. As you know, I'm mostly interested in the welfare of human beings in religious experiences, contact with the deceased and so on, and they themselves are not particularly interested in even examining, some of them even resented examining psychic or spiritualistic phenomena from a scientific point of view. But in 1977, in a number of different places on this planet, you had people from both groups, from the psychical group and the scientific group, who were beginning to uncover some of the great mysteries that have baffled mankind for the last 2,000 years. And that process is going on full swing right now. So this secret knowledge business is going, and it's operating, and amazing discoveries are being made that never get into Science Magazine or Nature or the other distinguished publications. So in a sense, the far-out physics underground is far-out, and it isn't physics, and it is underground, mostly by choice, because people who are doing the work don't want to spend all their time telling their colleagues and getting into these great polemical arguments that go nowhere. They'd rather go ahead and get the work done and get the proof out and get mankind jockeyed into a new position where a totally new understanding of the role of the mind, of the soul, of human life, its origins and so on, occurs. And of course, the area I've been speaking about, extraterrestrial contact. Now, I might say there are people who have had unusual contacts with extraterrestrials who have been very quiet about it and continuing that relationship on behalf of humanity. So I think somewhere at the end of 1977, we had a great watershed in human history, and somewhere